Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's January the 31st, 2013. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, Obongo has been duly re-immaculated, and our lords and masters in Congress are back in session, and they've hit the ground running. First off, the so-called Gang of Eight in Congress has now come up with the first version of a so-called Immigration Reform Bill, otherwise known as the Register 30 Million New Democrats to Vote Bill. Yeah, looks like that's right on track to get those beaners on the voter rolls by 2016. There won't be any need for Democrat vote fraud from then on. In an ironic sort of way, from then on they will be able to claim that they've won all the elections fair and square, which in a sense they did. The Democrats won't actually be cheating like they did with Acorn in 2008 and like they did with Ohio and Pennsylvania in 2012. They've just stacked the deck so that from now on white people will be completely shut out of power. The incredibly ugly Jew Dianne Feinstein has let us get a look at the final version of her gun control bill that she will be presenting to the Senate. It outlaws 150 specific weapons, including most automatic handguns, with registration requirements for weapons that are quote-unquote grandfathered. Bans magazines, over 10 rounds of course, so only the thugs in the black body armor will be allowed to have those. And the big enchilada, which has already been established by imperial decree from the dictator himself, ruling without Congress at all, so-called universal background checks. Now, a lot of people think that this is aimed at shutting down gun shows. Well, yes, but I think some people are missing the most sinister aspect of this. With all the grandfathering and the demands for universal background checks any time a firearm changes hands, what it does is, A, it effectively outlaws private sales of any kind, since an individual seller and buyer will probably have neither the time nor the resources to run a background check on one another. B, it thereby creates a criminal offense, which the secret police can then use to get a handle to pry their way into somebody's life on the basis of a so-called gun crime, i.e. selling or giving a shotgun to your nephew for Christmas or whatever. This will give the courts the excuse to rule that you are a gun felon and ban you from possessing any guns at all, which the militarized police and the black body armor can then use as an excuse to come to your home and seize your weapons. And C, all of this is headed in one basic direction, which is the de facto, if not outright, legal creation of a large, if not completely universal, registration database, which will tell our lords and masters who has got what guns and where. The BATF and the militarized police and the black body armor can't actually come to people's doors and take your guns away unless they know who's got them and where. Always remember, registration has to come first before confiscation. As with immigration, if the few remaining spineless Republicans in the House of Representatives squeal and sob about this, the dictator will just sign an executive order giving himself what he wants. I remember, he's ruling without Congress now, and anything we do see going on in Congress is just a dog and pony show. Remember the story about the frog slowly boiling to death as the water in the pot gradually increases in temperature so slowly that the frog doesn't notice? All this jumping and shouting in Congress is basically the slowly heating water. It doesn't really signify because the dictator has discovered that he can do whatever he wants and no one will do anything about it. He can just sign an executive order and his employees, who serve him for money, obey, just like King John's servants did before the Magna Carta. He's already signed one such decree authorizing universal background checks, which the BATFE can interpret however they want, and he can sign another one demanding the creation of a national database, and his servants will fire up those computers right away, if indeed they're not already doing that without congressional authorization, as I personally suspect that they are. Oh, and Benjamin Netanyahu got reelected in Israel, so an unprovoked attack on Iran, which may well destroy the world as we know it, is back on the agenda. But we'll have plenty of time to talk about current events in the coming months. Right now, I want to go all theoretical on your ass, and I want to talk to some guy in Sweden whose name I don't know. We have a new migrant in the area who, in turn, has a friend in Sweden whom I gather kind of brought him into the movement as a whole. Now, as you know, we have a lot of Swedes on our list. We interviewed Comrade Ragnar last summer when he and his family came here to visit. I recently did an interview with the Swedish magazine Realisten, I think I'm pronouncing that right, and I have a lot of Swedish email correspondence. Our new migrant's friend, like a lot of Scandinavians, is a bit concerned over working with National Socialists such as myself, not because of the racial aspect of the National Socialist philosophy, but because of the socialism thing. Now, having grown up in a social democratic welfare state, this Swedish comrade, naturally enough, doesn't want anything to do with it. And having lived myself in the similar social democratic welfare states in the UK and in Ireland, I can well understand why. By the way, that is the correct way to designate these European countries like Sweden and the UK. They are not pure socialists by any means, since socialism doesn't work and it can't survive in any form without some kind of capitalism nearby to keep it on life support. Now, as it happens, I am a National Socialist, a follower of Adolf Hitler, as are some of the people who work with me in the Northwest Front. Others of our NF comrades are not. Some have a primarily religious orientation, Christian identity or neo-pagan or whatever. Some are old-fashioned libertarians and constitutional strict constructionists. Some are survivalists and Second Amendment people, so forth and so on. We're pretty much a mixed bag, and it doesn't matter. Our unifying force is our desire to serve the 14 words of David Lane by creating a sovereign and independent homeland for the white race here in the Pacific Northwest. But this fellow in Sweden is not alone in his nervousness about certain allegedly socialistic aspects of not just the National Socialist worldview, but my Northwest novels as well, wherein I describe what the coming Northwest Republic will be like. I think I know what he means, because, like I say, I've lived in that kind of society, and not as a tourist or a privileged American either, but on the bottom of the heap like the locals have. It's kind of hard to describe, but there is, a drabness and dreariness about life in the socialist welfare state that's hard to quantify, but it's there. George Orwell put it really well in the opening chapters of 1984. When I arrived in London the first time around and I saw those huge flat blocks and walked around the city with the Victorian and Edwardian houses from the white man's greatest historical era just crumbling away around me, I understood that book like never before. It's like it's always some horrible, dreary, interminable winter in those places. And the clock in the Chestnut Tree Cafe is always striking the lonely hour of 15. Anyway, this week I'm going to be talking about our version of socialism. To tell the truth, as much as I hate to compromise my personal principles, it was probably a good idea for me to stick the overt National Socialism back into my backpack for the March to Freedom. When dealing with Americans, we must always be aware of how low you have to shoot in order to get a hit. The American attention span is so short that if you ever hit them with anything that you have to stop and explain, then you can see their eyes glaze over and you've lost them, especially if it's something that sounds European or foreign. Americans all know, in the back of our minds, that Europeans are intellectually and culturally superior to us, and we hate them for it. Just as Europeans hate us for being so much more successful and wealthy than they are, and the French and the British in particular have never forgiven us for saving their asses from the Germans twice in the past century. Okay, now, this is going to be a long babble of mine here, so I'll tell you what. I'm going to go ahead and take first music break a little early so I can interrupt my long, boring voice. Hopefully, when you guys come back, you'll be able to concentrate on my philosophical digression here a bit better. I get occasional complaints that my music selections on here are all dreary and depressing and violent and negative, and why can't I just play something cheerful now and then? Okay. This is Alan Price.
If you have a friend on whom you think you can rely, you are a lucky man. If you found the reason to live on and not to die, you are a lucky man. Preachers and poets and scholars don't know you. Temples and statues and steeples won't show you. If you've got the secret, just try not to blow it. Stay a lucky man. A lucky man. If you found the meaning of the truth in this whole world, you are a lucky man. Like pearls instead of chains, you are a lucky man. Takers and fakers and talkers won't tell you. Teachers and preachers will just buy and sell you. When no one can tempt you with heaven or hell, you'd be a lucky man.
By the way, that is from the soundtrack of one of my top five most truly strange and bizarre movies of all time called Oh Lucky Man. It stars Malcolm McDowell and a very young Helen Mirren, which makes it worth watching just for her. Okay, back to my heavy pontification on the true meaning of socialism in an Aryan society. Here goes. Bear in mind, this is necessarily seen from the American National Socialist viewpoint, Rockwellite, if you will. There are still a few people to whom the very word socialism conjures up visions of the Kremlin and the gulags and hammers and sickles, and they simply can't get around that idea, even though it's completely incorrect. Now, the first thing I want to explain to you is that there are many different kinds of socialism. You're probably most familiar with the kind known as communism, as originally formulated in the middle of the 19th century by the Jew Karl Marx. But there are several other kinds. There is the mild social democratic version of the European welfare states, what we here in America call liberalism. Okay, not exactly, but getting closer and closer all the time now under Obama. The principles are basically the same. Liberals are really Marxists without the courage of their convictions. You might say that liberals are decaffeinated Marxists. Then there are all the various weird ultra-left versions of Marxism, like those that are practiced in North Korea, Venezuela, Cuba, etc., the Shining Path in Peru, Bob Avakian's weird mishmash, this kind of stuff. Most kinds of so-called socialist philosophies are, in fact, some variation of Marxism. This is where National Socialism differs from all the rest, because our socialism is not based on the writings of the Jew Marx, but on the character of our Aryan race. Now, Marxist socialism, or communism, is, in essence, the flip side of the coin of capitalism, which I've discussed earlier on in these podcasts. Like capitalism, Marxism holds that man is essentially an economic unit of production and consumption, a cog in the wheel of a great machine that needs to be fed and lubricated and maintained and then thrown away when he can no longer perform his allotted function. Both of these concepts are essentially Jewish. Man without a soul. Man without any spiritual component, without any dreams, without any aspirations, without any imagination, with only needs to be fulfilled and appetites to be sated. Yes, I know I've said this before, and possibly some of you are getting bored with it, but I'm going to keep on repeating it because there is no more important lesson for you to learn regarding the nature of today's world. Our struggle is largely one of spirituality and idealism against materialism. And the two forces which have shaped the 20th century and which still pretty much control our destiny even today, communism and capitalism. Both of these are profoundly materialistic philosophies, philosophies of man, not God. Man, the body, and not the spirit. Now, this is where National Socialism differs so greatly from both of them. How can I put this? National Socialism is based on man, while the others are based on matter. At any rate, to get back to the central topic, our socialism is not materialistic or economic. It's based on the now almost obsolete concept of social duty. The idea that no man is an island, and that along with rights and privileges, we all have duties and obligations to our communities and to the culture and people into which we were born. Now, this idea used to be commonly accepted to the point where no one questioned it. Now, it has virtually disappeared from our national life. Our socialism teaches that there is something more important in life than the frantic pursuit of little green pieces of paper and the temporary security and pleasure that these little pieces of paper can bring. Our socialism is the socialism of the man who doesn't just sit and watch while his neighbor's house is on fire, he helps to put the fire out. We are in the terrible situation we are in today largely because we have decided that each of us can go our own way and to hell with everybody else. White people have decided voluntarily to strip ourselves of our racial and cultural identity because it interferes with making money and enjoying strange sex and playing with electronic toys. Now, in doing so, we become exactly what the capitalist system wants us to be, economic units of production and consumption and nothing more. But we are not born as faceless, raceless, cultureless beings who are only good for working and buying things at the mall. Race and spirituality are genetic for us. They are in our blood. And those qualities are in themselves a kind of socialism because they form a bond between all the peoples of the Aryan race. Our socialism is first of all a kind of a sense of community, which people in healthy Aryan societies have always demonstrated and no one else has. Secondly, there is a difference between big government as defined by the liberals and the red socialists, i.e. what we now have in this country, and responsible government. While National Socialists do not believe in a cradle-to-grave welfare state, and while we support free enterprise, we do understand and believe that the state has certain moral and economic and political obligations to its citizens. Never fall into the trap of so-called libertarianism. Libertarianism is basically just a moral front for the worst kind of laissez-faire 19th century-style buccaneer monopoly capitalism. Libertarians have this idea that the state needs to be kept as weak and as completely close to non-existent as possible, and for that some people call them anarchists, which they're not. They are capitalists, most of whom worship a Jewess named Ayn Rand as their kind of guru. Now, I think most libertarians know perfectly well what would happen if the state were to wither away or disappear. We wouldn't have freedom. What we would have would be the large multinational corporations stepping in to fill the gap. So let's shit-can this libertarian idea that the state is always bad. That depends entirely on who is controlling the state and what purpose the machinery of the state is being put to. In an Aryan society, the state does have duties and obligations to the Aryan folk which go beyond maintaining an army and a post office. The state has the obligation to ensure that everyone has the right to a job and the right to earn his living and support his family in peace and security. Furthermore, the state has a duty to make sure that jobs exist, that the common economy is being run sufficiently well and competently to produce employment and prosperity. The state has the obligation to ensure that no citizen is denied necessary medical care because of lack of money. The state has the obligation to ensure that every one of its citizens has a decent and affordable place to live. The state has the obligation to ensure that white children have a clean and safe and livable environment in which to grow up. The state has the obligation to ensure that no white man or woman suffers in their old age from cold or hunger or deprivation. Now, there is nothing wrong with these duties or with using tax money to implement them so long as they're done by and for white people. You need to understand that, like everything else on the continent of North America, so-called welfare dependency and socialistic policies are a racial issue. Always remember that. Everything in America comes down to race. Always, always, always. Present-day welfare dependency is a problem because recipients of these welfare payments and scams are overwhelmingly black, or else, increasingly, mud-colored third-world immigrants. The abuses of the welfare state are carried out almost entirely by blacks and third-worlders. In the social services area, like every other aspect of American life, the vast improvements which would be achieved by removing blacks and non-whites from our society really boggle the mind once you sit down and think about them. As for the welfare dependency mentality, which occasionally does appear among white people, especially in Europe, this would disappear once these people living in council estates and whatnot were shown that they have a stake in society once again. That the state was being run by white people, for people, and for the common good of the race and the nation, and not just as a grab bag of goodies to be given away to everybody with a black or brown skin. Sure, especially since our present one-party dictatorship came to power 4 years ago, some white people have developed a bad attitude towards welfare and food stamps and whatnot. They've developed an almost negroid sense of entitlement, although, of course, thanks to the economic destruction of the Obama Depression, a lot of these white families have been in genuine need of help, even if the blacks and the browns do continue to take the lion's share. A certain white people, especially young white people, look around and they see blacks and Mexicans and Cambodians and Filipinos and God knows what else getting all of this loot from the government, and they take the attitude, hey, why shouldn't I get some? That's not the best attitude in the world, but it's understandable. It's just like in high schools. This is why white boys turn into Whiggers. They see the black kids getting away with stuff. Now, in National Socialist Germany, after the revolution in 1933, not one single white child went hungry. Not a single German family went without a home. Not a single German worker was unemployed within a year or so after the triumph of the Führer and the NSDAP. The whole nation pitched in with winter relief programs and things like one-pot meals once a week until the economy was fixed and Germany went back to work. Marxist labor unions were abolished and a genuine labor front was established to represent all German workers, established so successfully that right up until 1945, German industry was still in full production for the war effort, and invading Allied troops found factory lines still churning out supplies and munitions. Efforts like that are not made by disgruntled or oppressed workers. An entire social services structure was erected in order to support the German family and bring order and peace and tranquility to German society. And right up until 1945, it worked. The Reich's labor service created the mighty autobahns, which are still used today, and they reclaimed millions of acres of arable agricultural land from swamps and from the sea to feed the German people. Now, these are the guys that you can see parading with their spades in Triumph of the Will. So you know this labor service I talk about in my Northwest novels? It was real. It was done once. Medical facilities and childcare in Nazi Germany were the best in the world for their time. Possibly for all time, since there was a racial basis to them. Social problems like divorce, alcoholism, and homosexuality virtually disappeared because Germans were a community once again, just as we will be someday. That's true socialism in action. Now, there are certain elements of socialism that the Northwest Republic will have to adopt and adapt from the Third Reich model as a matter of economic necessity, especially to survive in the face of what will certainly be crushing economic sanctions from the United States and the rest of the world. There is also the matter of preventing the establishment of laissez-faire capitalism, which, by the way, is not the same thing as free enterprise. Mom and Pop's grocery store on the corner is free enterprise. Walmart is capitalism. George Bernard Shaw once wrote that society needs to offer its members equal protection both from the burglar and the banker. In view of what bankers have done to us over the past 4 years, I take his point. When the time comes, we will do what we have to do in order to survive. This is one of the main reasons why I wrote Freedom's Sons, about the first 50 years of the Northwest Republic's existence. In that novel, the longest I ever wrote, the most important part probably comes during the first 150 pages or so, when I describe the measures which will be necessary to sustain economic and social life support in the face of a hostile world. And yes, some of that's kind of socialistic, like state monopolies on liquor and tobacco and the labor service and the power of government to commandeer private property, most of which was left behind by Jewish and capitalist runaways, as they were called. But always remember, we're not trying to create an all-white socialist society. We're trying to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. Whatever we do in establishing the Northwest American Republic will be a means towards that end.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I would like to talk about Alexander Dugin's book, The Fourth Political Theory. Now, I have to admit, as I was reading this book, I was very much struck by how intellectual and how abstract it is, but I have to admit that I felt that it seemed to belabor certain points, and then I found myself very much waiting for the punchline, waiting for the application of these concepts, which I felt in some sense rather let down in the sense of waiting for a clear application. Now, this book is about core political ideas. It says that in the 20th century, the West had three core competing political ideologies. The first was liberalism, which had been developing for some centuries prior to the 20th century. And then the other two were Marxism and variants of Marxism like communism. And then the third was fascism. Now, as we know, Marxism persisted for a long time into the 20th century, whereas fascism as a political hard drive or as a political force ended much more quickly than communism did. So this author is saying that basically right now the only hard drive of society in the West and the only unifying influence and globalizing influence right now is liberalism. This author really hates globalism and is also very worried about this idea of the end of history ending with liberal democracy. This author feels that in order for any people to have an identity, there must be a time continuum, a sense of past, present, and future. And so this author is very concerned about this end of history idea. Essentially, the author's answer to the absolute victory of liberalism is to bring in the better parts of the Marxist critique and also the traditionalism of the fascist viewpoint. This author, though, is also one who really loves tradition, and because of this love for tradition, is eager to become alive what might be considered strange bedfellows. So this author is really very tolerant when you consider you think of an author writing a book like this as perhaps very intolerant, but this author really, in this book, is really writing from a very multicultural perspective. If you really, you know, read the book, they're very much for regional developments and against any kind of globalism, even a globalism that would promote Western culture. And this author really does not want the Western culture to lose its identity, but at the same time, Alexander Dugin does not want Western culture to become globalized throughout the world. This author really has very harsh words about globalism, calling it a disease. The author also talks about the political soldier, and I found that aspect of the, even though it's rather brief and doesn't come until the end, I found that very intriguing, because if anyone has political soldiers, I think we have them in this organization. So I hope that the author is overly pessimistic in saying that the only political soldiers that exist today are really false. Ultimately, this author talks about the analogy of the fish out of water. The age of Pisces is about to come to an end, and there's this fish that's come on to dry land because it thinks it can live there. But the author says, let us follow the other fish in the deep water. So I found that also a very profound idea. The author talks a lot about the concept of being and the philosophies of Heidegger, and so that's another interesting part of this book. I think this author also talks a lot about Iran, Russia, and China, and really feels that Russia in particular is a key to global freedom, in the sense that although Marxism predicted a certain time spectrum that there would be this capitalism and then turning to communism, what really happened in Russia was that communism fell and then it became capitalist. So the author says that Russia really shows the reversibility of time. The author finds this very important, because if time can only go in one direction and it's absolute, then, as the author points out, there is no system that can only progress in one direction, and uses the example, for instance, of mechanics, that if any system were to keep advancing, eventually you have a point of breakdown. I would say that this book is really very abstract and possibly Aesopian in its language, and can be a bit of a slow read because there is a lot of repetition or making the same point over and over in the same respect. But I think these types of books are always valuable in the sense that they have, in some ways, a perspective different than you would get from someone who is more, I suppose, blunt or more crass. This is a fairly nuanced position. Again, like a lot of this type of literature, the applications are very foggy. So I hope you enjoyed this review, and maybe you'll take the time to read this book. And it's another book that's available at Counter Currents. So thank you very much for listening.
Okay, we got another White Reichel song now from Comrade Arland in the UK. Arland's stuff on the piano might sound a bit lilac after some of the skinhead rock we played on here, but remember that a whole lefty lib folk music movement started back in the 1950s in the coffee houses with the so-called beatniks and the beat poets, and they sounded kind of like this, well, some of them anyway. At least we are slowly developing our own canons of music and our own nationalist literature. The song is called White Revolution.
The age of guilt is over. The ruthless shall inherit the earth. Create a new world order. Destroy the enemy within. White revolution, united front. Ethnic identity, white revolution, united front. Ethnic identity, white revolution. Reject the culture of hollowness. Reject the logic of greed, the intellectual toxin poisoning your soul. White revolution, united front, ethnic identity. White revolution, united front, ethnic identity. White revolution. Duty to the future and our duty to the past. A self-fulfilling prophecy. Destiny brings us home.
This week, we celebrated the 80th anniversary of the German Revolution, when Adolf Hitler took power on January the 30th, 1933. It was a great day for our people, possibly the greatest in our history, because for the first time, the white man stood alone and conscious of who he was. For the first time, we had a state of our own wherein we were ruled by the racially conscious elements of our people, who governed in the name of the entire race, not the king or the Kaiser, not capitalism and profit, not God or the Church, not Karl Marx, but who ruled in the name of our own blood and heritage. Every now and then I get critical comments from some of you who remember me from the old days, ranging from the sad to the hostile, to the effect that I've lost my soul and I'm no longer my dear old Nazi self, that I've been corrupted by kosher nationalism or nationalist conservatism or Northwest utopianism or whatever, and that I've generally gone soft. Sometimes I get asked, where is the good old Harold who stepped out on the Daily Plaza back in 1978 proudly wearing the swastika? Oh, he's still around. Look, folks, let me make one thing crystal clear. I'm a National Socialist just as much now as I was then. And that's not going to change. Now, you may either believe this or not, as you choose. I'm not, however, quite so old a dog as to be completely unable to learn new tricks. And I have always been capable of rethinking and reassessing the strategic and tactical situation, and changing my views accordingly. Damn slowly, to be sure. Now, one of the genuine arguments against me as a fearless leader, which, needless to say, none of the goat dancers have sufficient intelligence or depth of insight to make, is that I'm a slow learner in some areas. Now, the essence of what all too many people consider true National Socialism is a slavish imitation of the tactics, organization, and outward appearance of the NS-Kampfzeit of 1920 to 1933 in Weimar, Germany. Now, that epic adventure is an incredibly heroic saga of our folk, granted, and I, in fact, revere it so much that in my next real novel, if I ever do get the time and the resources to write one, I will quite possibly set that book during the Kampfzeit. I've always wanted to do a fictional tribute to the Germans. I'm not quite sure why I've never gotten around to it. Inspiration is an odd thing. You can't just turn it on and off like a faucet. Anyway, this gets back to the idea that it's possible to base a revolution, any revolution, on a previously successful one. Well, I don't completely rule it out, but it's only partially true. Che Guevara found that the tactics that worked to treat in Cuba in 1958 laid a goose egg in Bolivia 9 years later. The Shining Path learned the hard way that modern-day Peru is not China in the late 1940s. The brutally inescapable fact is that the ideology and the tactics of the 1930s are no longer relevant to much of anything in today's world. Not even so much anymore in the field of propaganda. Hitler and Mussolini never had television and the internet. It's taken me way, way too long to learn this, but what can I tell you? Eventually, even I got my arms around this. We have to stop trying to reproduce what Hitler did down to the last brown shirt. His situation, his strategy, his tactics, and his presentation were unique to his time and place. That was 80 years ago, and the clock cannot be turned back. I know, I keep saying that we have to bring back a kind of white man and woman whom our great-grandparents from that era would have recognized. And I believe that's possible. Now, our own character within us, that we can change if we find the strength and the will within ourselves to do so. And I suppose you might call that a form of time travel or turning the clock back, but the trouble is that we can't take the whole world with us on that trip. Wish we could. But actual time machines don't exist outside science fiction. If for no other reason, the difference in the sheer size of the territory rules out an NSDAP-style mass movement in North America. The element of overwhelming territorial expanse is one of the main reasons for the Northwest Imperative in the first place. We have to reduce the problem to physically manageable dimensions while still glomming on to enough territory for the remnants of the white race to migrate to and survive in. A 1930s Germany was, by comparison to North America, a small territory connected by a superb mass public transportation system. The SA moved mostly by train, and during the Kampfzeit it was not uncommon for an SA troop to attend 3 or 4 events per weekend in several German cities, traveling on the trains, sometimes by specially chartered trains depending on how the party's finances were looking that week. Today, in Britain and Europe, when right-wing parties have some of these fairly large demonstrations that we see over here, once again, we are talking about comparatively small countries where the participants can travel mostly by cheap public transportation. In this country, on the other hand, we have to try and get our people to drive 1,500 miles to attend a single quote-unquote rally, and I use that term loosely. Ask Billy Roper how that worked out for him. I think many of us will be familiar with the typical American so-called racist rally, in which 29 or 30 people show up, all of them the same old faces, and some of them have driven across 5 states in some 12-year-old beater car or van, and they can't stay after the march because they have to head right back, because everyone is so poor that they can't afford a motel and they have to be back at their shit jobs on Monday morning. Guys, we're not going to build a Weimar-style mass movement with what we've got. We need to stop trying and play the cards we've been dealt in the form of cellular organization of small groups and the creation and slow building of communities in primary settlement areas here in the Northwest, so that someday this problem of distance and our tiny, tiny numbers can at least be somewhat rectified. Now, all that having been said, I do believe that with intelligent study and analysis, it is in fact possible to draw certain very limited general parallels between the present American situation and a few, not all, a few revolutionary situations which have existed over the past 100 years. Now, has anyone besides myself noticed that most modern successful insurrectionary movements, including the insurgent victory in Iraq, and yes, the Iraqis did, in fact, run the Americans out of their country. They won. Anyway, has anyone noticed that the most successful revolutions have been colonial wars, the object of which is to remove an occupying power from a finite piece of geography by making not the generals, but the accountants surrender? Okay, that doesn't apply to everything, I know. The Bolshevik Revolution in 1917 and the Iranian Revolution in 1978 were not true colonial wars, but most of the rest have been, including the so-called Arab Spring, if we take the view that Mubarak and Gaddafi were Western puppets, which they were. Now, another thing, believe it or not, I'm not a complete idiot. Yes, really. I understand that the situation regarding freedom of expression in America has deteriorated drastically since Obama came in, and there are certain topics that are now off limits for public discussions because they'll bring the crash of a kicked-in door in the pre-dawn hours. Now, this means that the entire subject of how to bring about racial and social change in America can't be seriously discussed, when any mention of what we would have to do is likely to bring the militarized police and the black body armor to somebody's door. Now, those of you who have read my Northwest Independence novels know how I've handled this problem. It's worked thus far, and it's kept me tapping away at this keyboard. How long it will continue to work is anybody's guess. I'm sure my attitude has been noted in the bowels of power. But I will say this. I believe that within certain parameters, and with a firm recognition of the historical and cultural differences involved, the model that we Americans need to be looking at is not Weimar Germany, but Ireland. Especially the 1916-1923 period, as opposed to the 1968-1998 period. This is a far more applicable and adaptable, quote-unquote, business plan than that which was used in Germany in the 1930s. I will say that this is a conclusion that I've reached after many years of study and also through personal first-hand observation. And before I start getting email after email howling with outrage from the UK, yes, I know the provos are communists. I lived there, remember? I lost my business in Dublin to the bastards. Believe me, I know. I'm talking about a purely objective and disinterested study of a strategic political model for racial change. And the condition we're in right now as a race, we damn better well be prepared to learn from anybody we can. Now, I'd like to suggest the following resources for those of you who are interested. I was going to read out some books and authors here, but that sounds really lame on a podcast. So if any of you are actually interested in learning about all this, you can email me at nwned@earthlink.net, and I'll send you a resources list. Now, for those of you, mostly younger people, who, through no fault of your own, have grown up in 21st century America and gone to public schools, and who therefore have difficulty with attention span and reading a block of type for content, you need to go to Blockbuster and rent the movie Michael Collins, starring Liam Neeson. That's kind of complicated, and a lot of Americans have trouble with the accents and also with the attention span, but give it a view if you can. Now, there's some other good movies about the Troubles out there, but mostly in the UK, and they're very hard to get over here. You'd probably have to buy the DVDs from obscure sources online. Now, if you have that kind of money for old rope, then Harry's Game, Cal, and The Price aren't bad. The Year of the French was good, but it's about the 1798 revolution, so it's not too applicable to 2013. There's an old version of The Informer from the 1940s with Victor McLaughlin, which was great. It's probably floating around on some DVD oldies collection. Now, if you're going to be ordering UK videos, make sure that they are in an American-compatible format. There is some kind of DVD format that they use in Europe that won't work on American machines, and a lot of the more obscure British stuff is in this off-brand format. Americans have a very simplistic view of Ireland, and their movies on the subject aren't anywhere near as good. Although I recently saw The Devil's Own with Brad Pitt, and that wasn't too bad. Ryan's Daughter is, although it does star the youthful tits of Sarah Miles. And for sheer novelty, there's Robert Mitchum playing a mild-mannered Irish schoolteacher, if you can believe that. Actually, my favorite of all American movies about Ireland is The Quiet Man, but that's not an Irish movie, it's a John Wayne movie. Anyway, I'm lapsing into senile babble about movies, so that's usually a sign that I need to wind this up. Just to reiterate, I am just as much a National Socialist as I always was, but the fact is that times have changed, and we no longer have the luxury of not changing with them. We have to live and work and struggle in the world as it is, not as we would wish it to be. I know. I tried it the other way for the first 15 years or so of my career, and I wish I'd copped on sooner. Okay, a comrade sent me this for our third music break. I'm not sure exactly what it is. It may be some kind of Scandinavian metal music. I know every time I play any of this stuff, I always get corrected. No, Harold, that's not Norwegian black metal. That's Danish skald metal, so forth and so on. Anyway, this may be just a Scandinavian folk group of some kind. The group is called Volvan, and the song is called Hagalaz's Rune Dance. I tried to look them up on the internet, but the only references I could find were all in Swedish or Norwegian or Danish, whatever their language is, so I can't tell you anything about them. Now, you recall what I said before about our kind of rock-style music? Loud and badly mixed instrumentals, soft and poorly mixed lyrics that can barely be understood because they're not being sung, they're being tunelessly screamed. This isn't quite that bad, but if you're finding it difficult to understand, don't worry about it. It's not in English. It's in their own Scandinavian language, whichever one that is, and that's why you can't quite catch the lyrics. Okay, I'm going to say something now that isn't a criticism, it's just an observation. There are a lot of people involved in the white nationalist movement as a whole, a lot of people, and also some people who are in contact and at least somewhat involved with the Northwest Imperative, who are not, in fact, revolutionaries. They're what one might call racist reactionaries or nigger-hating conservatives. They don't want to change the existing system. What they want is to somehow revive the old one that they vaguely remember from the 1950s and 60s, if they're my age. Or, if they're younger, they want to achieve some version of their existing way of life, but without all the problems and the daily bullshit and petty humiliation caused by diversity. They want the internet and the mall and whatever else they've got, just without all kinds of niggers and third world scum running around hassling them personally in all the various ways that non-whites do. They want to change the world up to a point, but only in a kind of negative way, by somehow removing all the problem people. Okay, they deserve some points for that. At least they've come to realize that most of life's problems are caused by people. Now, that's definitely a step in the right direction. But you can't solve things just by pushing some kind of magic button and have X number of categories of people go up in a puff of smoke. They have a legitimate gripe. The old America made a promise to them, personally, and then didn't keep it. America has given the Jews and the nigs and the fags and every piece of third world trash the gold mine, while the white man gets the shaft. So these disgruntled conservatives become involved with the movement out of a perfectly justifiable rage and resentment and fear that their children will lose even what little their parents have managed to keep. I think it's fair to say that by this point in time, most white people have at least some vague feeling that something is wrong. And that includes what Rush Limbaugh calls the low-information voters, the white dumbasses. They voted for Obama because they're stupid and because they didn't want to lose their food stamps and EBT cards, which the Democrats told them that the Republicans were going to take away from them. But I don't think that means they're happy with the status quo. Now, they know that things weren't always like this, and I honestly believe that by now most white people understand that they're now a minority in this land and that they're in trouble. But they have little, if any, idea of how to obtain anything resembling the desired result. Insofar as they think about any solution at all, which isn't very far, they believe it's a matter of quote-unquote waking people up. We get that a lot in our own movement. Now, once people wake up, so the theory goes, some nice white guy in a good suit will come along and run for president. And he'll tell the truth about race, and there'll be lots of flag waving and singing of God Bless America, kind of a Tea Party type scene. He'll be elected and have a ticker tape parade, and all the Mexicans will then vanish in a puff of smoke, and the niggers will go muttering back to their shacks on the other side of the tracks, and the faggots will slither back into the closet. Gas will drop back to 28 cents a gallon, and some version of the world of the past will once more return, as if by magic. Except this time we'll have the internet and TiVo. No turmoil, no trouble, no fire and death and blood, and above all, no real need to get out of the armchair and incur any personal risk or danger or make any effort. The great poisonous myth of democracy is that all you gotta do is go into the little booth and pull that silly lever and all is right with the world. Never mind the fact that in the past two elections, the vote fraud that put Obama in office was blatant. Oh, we all know this. The news media even reported on it, but we don't allow ourselves to think about it because we simply accept in our own minds that there's nothing to be done. Well, there is something to be done, it's just that we won't do it. Anyway, the idea is that once people wake up, then all the problems will just kind of fix themselves. Now, in some respects, there's nothing wrong with this viewpoint. It's a comforting dream. And humankind has a tendency to go for comforting dreams. That's perfectly understandable and human, and it's the way that middle Americans are pretty much going to react absent any genuine in-depth political education and historical awareness. And it's quite correct as far as it goes. America has failed them and everybody else. America promises that if white people just get good grades and go to college, get an MBA, go to work for some big company, and wear a tie and stay off the grass and think nice, squeaky, clean thoughts, long as white people vote Republican if they want, but they always let the liberals and the Democrats win, then they'll be rewarded with the suburban lifestyle that they see on TV. America has failed in that promise. Failed wretchedly. America promised us all the Brady Bunch and has given us Family Guy, and eventually it will give us Soylent Green. Now, we all realize this by now. I think every one of these consumer yahoos really knows, down deep in his inner thoughts somewhere, that this gigantic clusterfuck called the United States is headed for a major meltdown. If not, a quick trip to the local mall or the grocery store where you can hear the constant gabble of Spanish will convey the message unequivocally. Large parts of this country aren't even part of the United States anymore. So some people react by joining the movement in some form or other, but in a state of confusion. They do so out of the humanly understandable and sympathetic motive of racial resentment. They just want all those black and brown faces to disappear. They want to quit hearing salsa music blaring in every parking lot, and that's about the sum total of their political awareness. Now, the problem is, racial resentment ain't gonna cut it as a solution. The problem with the United States is systemic. It is institutional. It is inherent, and it cannot be eradicated. The United States is a terminal cancer case complicated by Alzheimer's. The entire system has been on the verge of a complete breakdown for years, and can't even stand up to 19 guys with box cutters crashing planes into a couple of buildings without its economy collapsing for a couple of years. We can't rebuild our major cities anymore after major storms. It's not just that New Jersey and Long Island aren't back up and running yet. New Orleans still isn't 100% back up after Katrina 8 years ago. Now, every year it's going to get worse and worse as Obama's America starts sliding into the sea faster and faster. And establishing a one-party dictatorship can't stop it any more than beating the patient with a club can cure cancer. Now, I giggle at people who accuse me of wanting to set up a tyranny in the Northwest Republic. Now, we live in a society right now where torture is legal, where habeas corpus has been suspended, where the President of the United States now has the legal authority to execute American citizens at will, without charge and without trial, where it's possible to be arrested in secret, tried by a secret military tribunal, and executed in secret, where the government maintains a series of concentration camps across the world, which it fills by kidnapping people in foreign countries, where blind and unquestioning loyalty to the system has become the one and only civic virtue, where the secret police are archiving every email sent in the U.S. and compiling lists of what books people check out from public libraries, where the president is now ruling by decree without Congress, and nobody dares to say boo to him. Soldiers commit murder and torture on camera and remain unpunished. I mean, do I need to go on? And I'm supposed to be the one advocating tyranny? Guys, we can't get by anymore on yelling nigger, 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 beaner, 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 raghead, raghead, raghead. We've come up here in the Northwest Front with a solid and workable plan to end all this and replace it with a new nation. But now comes the hard part. White people must find within themselves the courage to actually do it. Now, I'm old enough to remember the tag end of the world of Ozzie and Harriet and the Brady Bunch, being able to walk home from school and turn on Dark Shadows at 4. Okay, I was a weird kid. And yeah, it was a nice world in a lot of ways. But it's gone. Now, I said before that we can't turn back the clock, and no, we can't, but we can turn back our own clocks inside ourselves, and we can become the men who marched by the Reichschancellery with the torches on that wonderful night 80 years ago. The United States of America is no longer a country. It is a disease, and we have to find a cure for it. Now we know what the cure is. Now we can do this. We have to go back in spirit, if not in body, to the old days and the old ways, where there was little law but much justice. We turned to democracy to solve our problems, and it gave us Democrats. We turned to the law, and it gave us lawyers. We turned to consensus, and it gave us millions of morons voting to re-elect Barack Hussein Obama. We turned to the ideal of peace, and it gave us a drugged stupor that keeps us flat on our backs while Jews rifle our pockets. The American dream was nice, but it didn't work out. The iron dream must return, or we will cease to exist. Guys, we have to go back. There's no other way. We must return to the sword. We must return to the way our ancestors did it for thousands of years if we want to survive as a people and a civilization. And we must have a law and state and a society like those our ancestors created. Simple. supple, practical, clear as crystal with none of the damp and fuzzy shades of gray wherein the Jew hides and thrives. We must create a law and a state that plays to our strengths. We must adapt the ancient ways to some kind of solution that is workable and that is adapted to the realities, the technology, and the forward motion of the 21st century. Not the 19th, not the Eisenhower administration, and not a fantasy world that never existed outside a television screen. Practically speaking, that means setting up a constitutional chop shop, taking an engine from here, a fender from there, a rear bumper from somewhere else, etc., and putting something together that works, something that is, in effect, a new order, and by that I mean new, as in 21st century. That's what we've done with the Constitution of our Northwest Republic. You can find it on our website at www.northwestfront.org. Check it out. This is our future. The American dream is dead. Only in the Iron Dream is there hope of life for our people. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98104. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sarsha on the Bond. Freedom.
Still is beating heart.